Yeah, okay, it's going. So when I refused to sign this, he said, "Well, okay." Back down the hall, he opened the door and he stuck his head in. And he said to Ron, "Well, if you're not going to sign it, I don't suppose there's any point in you coming in either." He didn't even ask him to sign it. And we were there for a short time, and you know, it's funny, every organization I ever went to, there was a guy like Schultz in every camp. But the best one was taken by that German actor. He was a great tall fella. He was in Stalag 17 as the chief Wehrmacht NCO, senior NCO. I've forgotten his name, but he did it just exactly the way it was. And this fellow that we had there at Vesoul was, his French was so terrible, even I could understand it. But eventually we left there and we went to 5A. This is a Straflager. Now that's even worse than a front Stalag. Stalag 5A. And I had a wallet with a funny compartment in it. I had an American $2 bill without the corners torn off. Which is quite unusual. I just kept it for keepsake. And I was wondering how I was going to get through the search, because all of us that went from Vesoul in a train about a day to Ludwigsburg, and they put us in another one of these barn or stable affairs, but it was all concrete floor. It was a big open one. It would probably be more like cow barn, but it was in the heart of the city though. And that night we slept, all of us in a row, on the cement. It's still winter. It was bitterly cold then, as I recall. There's a lot of snow. We spent one night there, and the next day we were funneled through a search into another room. And this time we had pieces of wood to keep us off the cement. And that was the coldest night of my life. I thought the bus garage in Meij was cold, but this was the coldest I've ever been. It was so painful that I can remember my hips just killing me. And I'd doze off, and you simply could not lie like that anymore. You roll over on the other one. If you laid on your back, the cold went right into your chest. It was incredible. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, the lights came on, and a German guard came in, and he asked for two guys that nobody could recognize what they were. And we finally figured out it was Glover and Masters. And I didn't care if they could take me out and shoot me. It'd be better to lie on that cold floor. So they gathered us together. I sneaked my wallet through, by the way. I still had that $2 bill.
You got it?
Sure. Anyhow, took us down to the train station, and they handcuffed us. And I could see then why they were having trouble with their trains. The piston rod glands were leaking so badly that they could hardly see the train for steam. You know, it was terribly wasteful. Got on the train. We had two guards. And it took us all day to get up to Frankfurt. And it was third class. If they had colonist cars in Germany, that's what this was, a colonist car. Everything was made out of wood. There wasn't a bit of padding in the seats or anything. But we'd been given a little something to eat. We still had from this French Red Cross, which we husbanded with great care. And I can remember the handcuffs, they were real old timers. It could have been 50 years old, mid-19th century things, and they kept falling off. I keep doing them up because I didn't want to get shot by these idiots, because we knew we were going to Dulag by now. And there's no way you're going to get out of the heart of Germany, so why get shot because your handcuffs fell off? Anyway, these two guards, I had a pair of clogs. They said, pick a pair of clogs when we left. The first dry feet I'd had. And you ever try walking up a hill on ice in clogs? They don't hang in there too well. So we had to walk from the station at Frankfort on Main up to where the Gulag Interrogation Center was. And the two guards stopped a woman. She had a bit of a shopping bag, and they were making a big deal with her with two packages of Prima Marge, so I knew where they were going that night. They had this thing all organized. I thought to myself, oh, well, luck of the game. We didn't have any. Maybe if I'd had some butter, I would have could swap places with the guards. They could have gone to jail. Anyhow, I slipped a couple of times walking up that hill with these clogs across the bones of my arch. That was severe. We used Russian socks. You put your foot in a piece of flannel, square flannel, and then you gather it all up around your ankle and tie a lace around it.
Russian socks.
That's what we called them, Russian socks. And then you put them in the clogs. And as a matter of fact, if you're just standing around, if you're in a cold shop or something like that, perfectly good.
This was in Frankfurt. You were slipping and so on.
Yeah.
You were just walking through the streets?
Yeah, the two of us, two guards and the two airmen.
Any civilian response to you?
Very little then. We had a couple of lectures in Gulag once we were into the transient camp. And the fellow that gave us the lecture was spoke English as an American. He was an American.
He was an American.
Yeah, he grew up in the United States, but he went back as, he belonged to the German Bund and the whole thing. So, oh no, he got the point across, no trouble at all. And he said, we were taken in cattle trucks from the transient camp to the train station. And he said, do not whistle at any blonde girls. They take a dim view of that from POWs, especially from this camp, because this is a Luftgangster camp, so don't you guys forget it. Well, I don't think any of us are in the mood for whistling at German girls. But I was saying that we got the first taste of what the prison camp was structured like, you know, with the barrack blocks and that sort of thing. But they had a mess hall. The only time I ever saw a mess hall there. And all good Red Cross grub. That was the best meal I had since I left Belgium, was the first meal I had there. And they had, I thought it was peanut butter, a can of stuff. They take the can right off and you lid off and you spread this on your bread, and then it was milk jam. I've never seen it before or
milk
since.
Milk jam?
Yeah, it's made in Argentina. You got a lot of Red Cross stuff from Argentina, and it's condensed milk, and they condense it until it goes almost the color and consistency of peanut butter, and it's very good. It's excellent. But I dug into this thinking it was peanut butter, and I got quite a jolt when I bit into it. It didn't taste anything like peanut butter. And we were there for 3 or 4 days. We got to know a few chaps, and Ron was there, and Ron and I teamed up again. And we had an air raid, I guess the night before we left. We were all down the air raid shelter, and they flattened the place.
Frankfurt?
No, the camp.
Oh, the camp
itself. Yeah, we weren't afraid. There are bombs. They don't hurt. Hi. Well, might as well feel like that, because
was there much evidence of heavy bombing in Frankfurt itself when you walked through from the railway station up to the camp? The
part we walked through was out in the suburbs, so we didn't see an awful lot. I did notice the railroad station in Mannheim that all the ballast for all the traction are brand new. So we came up through Mannheim. That was the only place where the civilians looked as if they might have given us a hard time. But we were both dressed. We got issued with uniforms in Vesoul, which were First World War Foreign Legion uniforms. And I always thought of those guys hiking around in the desert with those big greatcoats on. You could see through them. They were terrible. Anyway, we looked like French Foreign Legion, so they didn't know who we were.
Were you handcuffed?
Part of the time. I think probably going through Mannheim we were.
No, you went by train.
Train, oh yeah.
So you were just traveling on an ordinary civilian
train with the two guards. Yeah, it wasn't even a compartment. That one was, it was like a very rustic old streetcar. They were dragging rolling stock out of the bulrushes and everywhere they could find it. Same as they did in this country. The colonist car I referred to was in use before the turn of the century. It had those straw wicker seats, and you flip the back over to face the other way.
Yeah.
That's what I went first when I was posted overseas. Across the Rockies in that thing in the middle of winter, and the frost forming on the inside of the windows.
Great.
Anyway, where are we here?
Well, we can, if you want to take a break, we can stop there for a while. Actually, can I just ask you one more question?
Sure.
Because something you said just sparked a question that I wanted to ask you about, going back to Belgium. You mentioned the First World War. Did any of the people that you worked with in the resistance in Belgium refer to the experience of having been occupied by the Germans in the First World War?
Oh, very much. Oh, you bet. As a matter of fact, Madame Bulpa, the senior, was widowed when the war came along. And she had been active in, of course, they weren't occupied for very long during the First World War, but they were right in the middle of the battlefields, and they billeted Canadian soldiers on more than one occasion, quite a few of them, and she told me that these Canadians had always said they'd come back and visit, but they never did. Well, you go back home, put your life back together, then get hit by the depression of the 30s, it's not likely that very many of them ever had the opportunity to get back at all. But she appreciated this, of course, but she said that it was always a disappointment, and she'd always wanted to see her boys again. And I lived or stayed with them prior to going down to Enghien when I was first trying to get out of back to England. And I was staying with them, with Madame Bulpa Sr. She had two daughters, grown daughters, living with her, Marguerite, who was 35, and Mimi, who was 31, and another daughter, Georgette, who was 29. And she was married, though, and she lived in the neighborhood with her husband, Willie, and their little daughter. But the two single girls, Mimi and Marguerite, lived with the old lady. And yes, she did mention quite a bit about the occupation during the war, and the word Sale Boche came from those days. They were not well received. And in 1959, I decided that I have a go at going back. And I had 3 months leave coming. I was with the Coast Guard then. So we went back in December of 59, and then in probably February, I guess it would be, we went over to Belgium and we visited these people again. First time I'd seen them. A lot of them I'd dropped out of touch with. Some I didn't see again until this last summer. But one of the people that we did go to see was Madame Bulpa, and their immediate family and friends, most of whom I knew. And they had a buffet supper for us. And it was something to behold. A groaning board just wouldn't quit. There was everything you could hope for. People would be, well, wine was flowing and toasts were being said. And Madame Bulpa was in ecstasy, this old gal. She looked like she was 105, but then she looked like that when I knew her the first time. She hadn't changed one bit. White hair kind of sticking out all over, and two or three teeth left, but that was about all. Well, she'd be, every time they had a toast, you'd have to get up. And I'd say, you don't have to get up. Because they'd given her the only easy chair in the room, and it was so far back there that a young fella would have trouble getting out of it. She'd struggle out of that chair for every toast. She said, I'm not going to miss this for anything. She'd cry one minute, and she'd laugh the next. But one of her Canadian boys had come back to visit her. And I was very pleased at that, and particularly so that because she died that following summer. So some little thing had come true for her. But they put, see, these people risked their necks, and I don't mean just a little bit. They risked not only theirs, but anybody who even knew them were vulnerable. And yet they take somebody like me in and not only feed them, but feed them well. Even according to wartime standards, I didn't suffer from malnutrition when I was in. Oh, sure, some of it was getting a little tedious because there wasn't much variety, but these people, as I say, I feel it's a moral obligation to go back and make my number with them once more. And I will do it again. I got more friends, re-established friendships this last summer that I didn't believe possible, especially with Ludo van Eek.
This is the man you had not seen in 59.
Yeah, and I thought was dead. That's why I didn't even look him up.
The confusion of the name and everything. Yeah. So do you feel, I mean, you really feel you've got a circle of friends there?
Oh, absolutely.
As close as anything.
I phoned half of them at Christmas, this last Christmas. I phoned Mimi, one of the Bulpa girls, and a widow of Albert Dumoulin, who was active in those days. They still live in the same apartment, these two old ladies now. Both going concerns. We stayed with them for a week this summer, and I thought at Christmas, I'll give them a call. With direct dialing, all I had to call, made 10 attempts, but I got through, and it was just like dialing anybody else's number. And of course, you could have knocked them over with a shovel when they found out who was on the other end. And we just talked for 2 minutes. It cost me, it's only $2 a minute. Cost me $4. Cost me almost that to send them a card. Time you buy the card and a rotten stamp. And I phoned Johnny Borman that I'd been with in Brussels during the war. And I had seen him in 60. And he squired us around quite a bit this summer. And I phoned him at Christmas. And I had a little trouble getting him off the phone. It was 13 minutes.
Could be dangerous for you.
It could be. Well, what the heck, that was well worth it. And then I phoned, I couldn't get through to Marius on Christmas. I didn't get through to him until the middle of January. But I promised to send him a book, and I haven't done it. I sent his grandchildren some of these National Geographic books for youngsters. They're excellent. We sent quite a few of those out. But the book Bomber by Len Dayton, I think I mentioned this before, is the story of the night I got shot down. So I promised to send Ludo this book, and in all the confusion of this, I didn't do it. I'm going to do that this afternoon. I'll go down and buy it.
Planning to go back?
Oh, I'll go back. Don't worry about that. But I can't do it this year. My pilot was not captured right away. I'm very vague as to what his adventures really did consist of. But he's never been back, and yet he's an Englishman. I can't understand these guys. They live right there, and it's only you could leave it just after breakfast, and you're there in time for afternoon tea, that they've never gone back.
Do you think that's a fairly common experience for people not to go back?
Oh, yeah. Well, it is over there because nobody seems to accept the fact that you can travel. I think it's still a lot of the old colloquial village attitude in a lot of people. They just, this is where I was born, and I'm not going up to London if I don't have to.
Do any of the Belgians ever go to England? Or
never heard. Well, as a matter of fact, now you mention that, I was with a Madame Legrand. I told you about the night the Gestapo, early morning, the Gestapo raided one of the places. All right, well, that woman came out right after the war, stayed with me here. And we were living in West Vancouver then, and then I drove her down to Seattle, I guess. Harry lived in Portland. And I had the fellow that was with us crossing the Swiss border. He was with Madame Legrand, too. And but that's the only one I know of. And she was quite well fixed as far as money was concerned. She didn't have to sweat it too much. And I found out after, one of the reasons she came over was to see us and also to see the country, because an American colonel that liberated her section of town, and she got quite friendly, and he wanted her to come to the States, which she subsequently did. She married him, and I have lost track of her. But she'd be getting on a bit now, too.
Did a number of the people you worked with get recognition by the Belgian government after the war?
I never heard of that. I've never heard a peep out of the Belgians myself. But all of them that I encountered have at one time or another shown me the little certificates that they got for working from the American and British governments.
Oh, from the American and British governments, for working with the...
For helping Allied airmen, yeah. Those, I've got those, some of those right here.